For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, I think the first and most obvious question we should ask ourselves is, what is discernment? I think maybe one of the best examples of discernment that's given to us is from the Old Testament in 1 Kings chapter 3. This is surrounding the story of Solomon giving this wise ruling. Now, a little bit of background on Solomon. You know, Solomon, after King David died, was appointed by God to be the king of Israel. And so God one day came to him and said, you know, I'll grant you one request. Whatever you want, just ask, and I'll give it to you. And so after some time, Solomon thinks about it and goes back to God and says, I'm but a child. And it's a little bit surprising since he was 40 years old at the time that he said that. But he meant that because, or he said that because he knew that he was not qualified to lead the nation of Israel as a young man. He wasn't skilled at leading as a king. And so he does something that really surprises everyone. He says, Lord, give me wisdom that I may rule your kingdom. And God was so pleased with that response, he says, I'm going to give you wisdom to the extent that people are going to regard you as one of the wisest people who's ever lived. And on top of that, I'm going to give you vast wealth. And so it was exactly that, that, you know, Solomon was regarded as this incredibly wise person in the ancient world. And there is tons written about how much wealth he had. Well, one day, sometime later, these two women come into his court with a dispute. And we're given this account in 1 Kings 3, verses starting in verse 16 through, 21 or 24. We're told two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. One of the women said, my master, this woman and I live in the same house. I had a baby while she was with me in the house. Then, 3 days after I had my baby, this woman also had a baby. We were alone. There was no one else in the house except for the two of us. This woman's child suffocated during the night when she rolled on top of him. Then she got up in the middle of the night, took my son from my side while I was sleeping, and she put him in her arms and put her dead son in my arms. I got up in the morning to nurse my son, and there he was dead. I mean, can you imagine how that must have felt as a mother? You know, you wake up to nurse your child and he's dead. She says, but upon close examination in the morning, I realized that he was not my baby. The other woman said, no, my son's alive, your son is dead. But the first woman replied, no, your son is dead and my son is alive. And they started to argue before the king, probably in a pretty heated way. Well, at one point, the king spoke, silenced the women. He says to his servant, get me a sword. So they placed the sword before the king. And the king said to the servants, cut the living child in two and give the one half to one and then the other half to the other. And so, as the servant grabs the sword, grabs the baby from the mother who's holding him, he says, I want you to cut this baby in half. And so, you know, as he is about to raise the sword and do what the king said, the unthinkable, the real mother spoke up to the king, for her motherly instincts were aroused. And she said, my master, give her the living child. Whatever you do, don't kill him. The other woman said, neither one of us will have him. Let him cut him in two. Really callous. Well, then the king responded, give the first woman the living child. Don't kill him. She is the mother. And there you have the story of Solomon's incredible wisdom. There are a couple things, I think, about this story that speak to our topic of discernment. I think the first thing that Solomon exhibited was the ability to judge truth from falsehood. That he looked at this case, obviously one of these women were lying, because both of them couldn't have been the mother. And so as the king, it was his job to adjudicate and to figure out who was telling the truth. And so Solomon had this incredible ability to probe in and to really locate the truth. And I think as Christian workers, this is something that we need to possess as well. That we need to be able to discern truth from evil. This comes up over and over again throughout the New Testament, especially when it comes to false teachers. Think about what the author of Hebrews says in chapter 5, verse 14, speaking about knowing God's word, understanding it. He says, solid food is for the mature, whose perceptions are trained by practice to discern both good and evil. So he says it takes training, it takes practice, it takes work to be a discerning person. So that over time, your perceptions are trained and practiced to discern. You know, this word discern in the New Testament can also mean to evaluate. And so when you hear something, you should be evaluating. Is this true? Is what's being said, does that fit with what God says in the Word? Well, it also, I think this story also points to Solomon's ability to read people and situations correctly. It's amazing that Solomon was able to grasp human nature to the extent that he knew how this woman would respond, how the real mother would respond to this edict that he gave to his servant to cut the child in half. He knew that the true mother, that her maternal instincts would kick in and that she would do anything, even give her son to this other woman in order to save his life. And so Solomon demonstrated this profound ability to figure out how human beings work. You know, and this kind of discernment really is something akin to like street smarts. You know how somebody you talk to somebody or you're around them and you get a sense that they're street smart? That's what I think Solomon was demonstrating here, that he was worldly wise, that he understood how people work and how they respond to certain situations. Well, there are some challenges, I think, when we talk about discernment that face us. There are some challenges. First of all, it's easier to describe cases of bad discernment than it is good discernment. You know, obviously in the case of Solomon, that was an exceptionally good example of discernment. But most of the time, we see bad examples of that. And I'm not really sure why that is. Maybe it's because there are a lot more wise people in the world than there are fools. The other way around, that there are a lot more fools than there are wise people. As we go through our talk here, I think the tone, the feeling that we're going to have is that it's a little bit negative, that it's describing cases of bad discernment. But I think it's important for us to face reality and to look that square in the face to realize, okay, maybe I've got a hole in my discernment. Maybe I've got a blind spot that I need to work on. Secondly, it's difficult to obtain discernment without actually seeing it. It's not really something that you can teach in a classroom setting. Most of the time, it's something that you absorb from being around somebody who is discerning. And, you know, that's why in our fellowship in Xenos, we really emphasize this concept of discipleship, personal discipleship. Because a lot of things in the Christian life can't be taught in a classroom setting. Most of the time, they're caught by actually watching people live out the Christian life. And so what I'm going to try to do in our limited time here is to give you some case studies and some examples that illustrate my points. And hopefully you can resonate with them. Okay, let's talk about the first area that I mentioned here, discerning truth from falsehood. I mentioned earlier that the New Testament speaks volumes on the subject of detecting false teaching. You know, think about the numerous cases throughout both the Gospels and many of the epistles that speak on this idea of being able to evaluate what's being said and determining whether or not what's being said fits with the biblical picture. You know, Jesus in Matthew 24 says that there are going to be many false prophets that will arise. Think about what Paul says to the Ephesian elders as he's giving them his farewell address. And in Acts chapter 20, he says there are going to be wolves that are coming in dressed in sheep's clothing. Not to mention John in 1 John says that there will be many antichrists. And so this is a warning that we see throughout Scripture. You know, and it's really not that easy, I think, to discern truth from falsehood. Because if it was, then we wouldn't see entire swaths of you know, the American church today being taken, swept away in false teaching. Many times these false teachers are very charismatic. They're likable. They're funny people. And, you know, they're not going to just come right out and say, I'm a false teacher. You know, false teachers don't say, okay, for our time here, I just want to preface this by saying, I'm a false teacher. Now listen to what I have to say. It's a lot more subtle than that. And most of the time, they're not going to say things that directly contradict what Scriptures say. Most of the time, they're going to ask questions. They're going to leave the door open in ways that undermines our biblical faith. Many times, it undermines the foundations of our faith, such as, what is truth? Can we really trust the Bible? A few years ago, I did this thought experiment at one of my men's Bible studies. I was teaching on this topic of discerning truth from falsehood, and I clipped, you know, a portion of a book from Rob Bell's book, Velvet Elvis. If you don't know him, he is an author, Christian author, who is a part of what's called the emerging church movement. And today, you know, he's been exposed as someone who does not believe in hell, is practically a universalist, and has strayed pretty far off from the Christian faith in many ways. But at this time, you know, he was sort of the new popular author that everybody was consuming, many evangelicals. And so without telling my guys that this was from Rob Bell's book or from, you know, Velvet Elvis or whatever, I just had them read this before we actually did our little study. And to paraphrase the section that we read, it said something like, what if one day scientists or archaeologists were able to produce 100% proof that Jesus had a biological father, and that his biological father's name was actually Larry? Would that shake our faith? Would that cause us to throw away our Christianity? Could we still walk with God? And of course he says, well, from my own perspective, I believe that Jesus was, in fact, God's son, and that the virgin birth is true, but I just want to ask the question. Would that shake the foundations of our faith? And so after reading that short segment, I was like, okay, so what do you guys think about this? And they sat there, you know, quiet, not really knowing what to say. And somebody ventured to say, well, you know, it doesn't seem like he's saying anything really bad. I mean, I could see where he's coming from. Maybe it's not that bad. And then, of course, you know, everybody else joined in. You're like, yeah, you know, I mean, it's kind of cool. He's not that bad. And so they looked at me, you know, trying to assess what I thought. And I said, okay, well, let me ask you this then. I said, why would he pinpoint something like the virgin birth? If we could prove that Jesus had an earthly father, then doesn't that mean that Jesus was merely a man? And if Jesus was merely a man, then he wouldn't really be the savior of the human race, let alone God himself, right? And they're like, good point. So, you know, The writing style was really catchy. You know, he had this kind of syncopated way of speaking in his writing. You know, he had one word sentences that was really cool at the time, and they were just like, man, this guy, he's cool. I mean, you know, I resonate with him. And yet they were failing to really ask themselves questions about the content of what he was saying. What are the implications? So it's not that easy. After all, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14, that even Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. You have to remember that when you are reading Christian authors, or reading a book, period, that whoever's writing that is agonizing, carefully crafting their work in order to persuade you of something. They're not just writing a book for no reason. They're trying to convey a point and persuade you of something. And you need to be able to discern what that is. So, a few suggestions on honing your discernment in this area. I think, first of all, learn the grammatical historical method of interpretation, which is really the common sense way of reading the Bible. That there was an original author that wrote this during a specific period of time, in a certain language, to a very specific audience. And so as interpreters, what we're here to do is to try to find out what the author intended to write to his audience. We're trying to uncover that. We're trying to understand it. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to understand it perfectly. It doesn't mean that every passage in the Bible is going to be very clear, crystal clear, what the author is saying. But as we grow in our knowledge, and I think as more information comes to the surface through biblical studies or documents that are uncovered, it's going to expand our understanding of what the author intended. And so as we continue to walk with God, our understanding of passages in the Bible should increase, even though it doesn't necessarily hit the point where we understand every passage in the Bible 100%. There are going to be things that are a little hazy. Secondly, read Christian books with a critical eye. Ask yourself intelligent questions as you're reading the text. Don't speed read through books. You want to sit there and reflect and ask questions. What's the implication of what he or she is saying here? Or more importantly, what's being left out? I think that's important to ask. What is it that she is not saying that's troubling? So I think asking yourself intelligent questions will help you to be a more discerning person when it comes to figuring out what is truth and what is falsehood. By the way, for those of you who are taking furious notes, I have my email address on the last slide, and you can email me, and I will give you my PowerPoint. That way you can just relax and just kind of take this in. There are audible sighs in the room. I could tell some of you are sort of stuck in that student thinking. Ask yourself this. Does this fit with what the Bible emphasizes? Oh yeah, not everything in the Bible is equally important. Everything in the Bible is true, but not everything in the Bible is equally important. There are certain things that are emphasized. The two being the person and work of Jesus Christ. And so, if you focus on those two things, or if the author that you're reading is focusing on those two things, then you know that what they're saying isn't too far off the mark. But in order to get a real understanding of what the Bible emphasizes, you're going to have to do the hard work yourself. And this is not going to come through, you know, a couple months of study. This is going to be a lifelong process where you understand what God emphasizes in the Bible. Also, ask yourself, is it in the text? I really love expository teaching. It can be a pain sometimes to do that, where you're standing up every week and you're just taking on the next passage that's in a book, because there are definitely some passages that you would rather not teach in a public setting, like church discipline or things like that that are a little bit controversial. But the fact that it's in there and that God mentions it suggests that we should talk about it. And I like just sort of following the flow of thought through a book. But I think it's important for us as we're sitting under teaching or we're reading a book that we're looking at our Bibles with our finger right on the text, on the passage that's being mentioned. We're looking up and we're thinking to ourselves, yep, that's right there. What it says right there in the text. You know, we shouldn't be like, well, I mean, she's seems like a nice person. She's well-spoken. She's really funny. Seems like a nice person. I'm sure we can trust her and what she has to say. You know, lemmings, as they are approaching a cliff, are saying that about the person in front of them. And so we need to be weary of, need to be aware that somebody who's very charismatic, who seems really smart, that shouldn't be enough for us to trust them. We need to see what it says in the text. Okay, I wanted to spend most of our time talking about discerning people and situations, which is really the other part that Solomon was demonstrating in that story. This kind of discernment resembles the Old Testament idea of wisdom. In Hebrew, the word that's used for wisdom is chokmah. And it's a word that describes a skill or trade. For example, in Exodus 28, verse 3, we're told, "Tell all the skilled men to whom I've given wisdom that they are to make garments for Aaron so he may serve me as a priest." So this is talking about the construction of the tabernacle. And God told Moses, he said, "I want you to get these skilled men to construct the priestly garments." And this would have been very difficult, especially in the ancient world, where they had to harvest flax. They needed to figure out how to weave together linen, harvesting dye, especially some of these dyes that were used, like purple. Was very expensive, very time-consuming, as well as learning how to embroider without a modern-day sewing machine. That would have been really tough. And so these guys exhibited what you might call wisdom, or the skill of being able to make garments for Aaron. Also, you have Exodus 36, verse 2. You know, Moses summoned Bezalel and Oholiab, whom the Lord had given ability and who was willing to come and do the work. These guys were finished carpenters. And so they needed to understand the properties of wood, how specific species of wood would interact with the kind of environment there in the ancient Near East, as well as how to join different pieces together. Imagine doing that in the ancient world without a lot of the modern tools that we have. I mean, this must have required incredible skill. You know, I'm really into different types of hobbies. And one of my many hobbies is that I like to ride bikes and fix up bikes. And I had this old vintage frame from the 80s, this old steel bike that I really like. And I decided that I wanted to get it refinished. And so I found a local guy who lives in Newark, Ohio, and he paints bike frames for a living. And so I called him up and I said, you know, hey, I'd like to have this refinished. And he said, well, why don't you come on over to my shop and you can just drop it off. That way you can save yourself some shipping. So I jump in the car with my frame and, you know, I punch in the address on my GPS, and it's leading me to this really rural area of Newark, Ohio. Sort of like deliverance country, you know? And so as I am driving, you know, my GPS is telling me you've arrived. And I'm looking around, and I'm like, there are just houses, driveways, really, in this rural area. And so I'm backing up, you know, trying to figure out if I missed it or if the GPS was off. And it just kept saying that, you know, this driveway that was leading to this house back off into the woods was this guy's shop. And so I decided, well, I might as well go up this driveway. And so I start driving up this driveway, which is, you know, maybe a quarter mile long, and it comes up to this house that has a bunch of junk and garbage in front of it. You know, an old ATV that hadn't been used for a few years, and I'm thinking to myself, this better be the guy. I'll be a little bit nervous knocking on his door. So I knock on the door, and there's no answer. And so I'm like, well, maybe I should just go back home. But, you know, this is about an hour away or more. But then I noticed that there were these faint tire marks that went further back into the woods along the side of this pond. And I thought to myself, it'd be a good idea for me to go back there. So I jump back in my car, and I'm led along this pathway deep into the woods, and there is this, concrete building back there with, you know, just steel tubes that are rusted and just a bunch of junk out there. And I'm like, well, I think I need to jump out of my car and knock on the door again. And so I knock on the door, and the door swings open, and there's this really big guy sitting there. Got this big, burly beard. He's wearing this Notre Dame sweatshirt that's shot through with holes, and he's clutching this 2-liter of Diet Coke that he's, you know, periodically taking swigs from, and he's like, can I help you? And I'm like, hey, are you Jack? And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, hey, I called you the other day about my bike frame and getting it refinished. And he's like, come on in. And so I walk in, and there are just, you know, tools everywhere, machinery, and, you know, the shop is a complete mess. It smells like a bowl of pennies in there. And I said to him, you know, I noticed that I had some trouble with my frame here, that, you know, I'm having a hard time jamming my seat post into the seat tube here. And he said, you just got a pinched collar. And he grabbed my frame out of my hands, started manipulating it with a screwdriver, flipped it upside down and put it on a machine, and started to, forget what the term is. But anyway, he fixed it. And he grabbed one of his seat posts, you know, which is a 27.2 millimeter seat post, and he just slid it right in there. And I just thought to myself, this guy really knows what he's talking about. And, you know, when I look at him, you know, he's skilled at bike frame building, not just because he understands how to operate the machinery in his shop, but he also understands the property of steel and how it responds to the environment, how it's going to respond under stress. And so in the same way, when we talk about wisdom or skill, especially when it relates to people in certain situations, we're talking about understanding people to the extent that we know how they're going to react to certain situations and certain scenarios. That's what you would call a discerning person. You know, discerning people understand how human nature works, that human beings are incredibly complex. Think about what David says in Psalm 139, verse 14. He says that, he declares of himself, he says, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. He understood that God gave humans incredible ingenuity, a near limitless creativity, and an incredible capacity for love and self-sacrifice. But the Bible also teaches that we have a dual nature as well, that there's a dark side to humanity. We're told in Jeremiah 17, verse 9, that human hearts are dark. Jeremiah says that, you know, the human heart is deceitful beyond all else. Who can even understand it? And we see that, you know, human beings will take their ingenuity and their incredible creativity and find and invent new ways to do evil. Or that capacity that God has given for incredible love and self-sacrifice, that we often turn that back onto ourselves in the form of self-centeredness and narcissism. And so in general, I think people who suffer from bad discernment usually have a faulty view of biblical anthropology. They're either too positive about humans, they see the good in people. And on the other hand, they're actually, you know, the opposite end would be that you're overly negative about people. Oh yeah, you can have bad discernment because you see the worst in people. Let's start with the first, seeing people in an overly positive light. You know, I think that for me, I was struck by my experience going to Cambodia a number of years ago, where we went to the killing fields of Cambodia, which this is where, you know, it was a mass grave where tens of thousands of bodies were buried during the Khmer Rouge regime. And I remember as we were walking through there, it was almost a surreal experience as we were weaving through what looked like impact craters where the bodies had been exhumed, thousands of bodies. And I remember walking along the path, and as the, you know, it had rained the day before, and so it had exposed a fabric from some of the victims, as well as pieces of bone. And as we would stop at certain stations, there would be a depiction of how Cambodian people during that time period were being killed in a genocide, really, of their own people. And as the tour finally led us to the end, we came up to this large monument that had skulls stacked about, you know, 20 feet high, cataloged from the oldest all the way to the youngest. And so as we quietly filed back onto the bus and headed to the hotel, it was complete quiet. Nobody said a word. And so as we got to the hotel, we went to a room where we sort of debriefed. It was a time for us to be able to process what we saw. Nobody said anything. But the person who guided us through there at one point broke the silence and said, "I'm sure many of you are asking yourself this question right now. How could anybody do that to another human being? How?" And of course, everyone in the room nodded. It was exactly what everyone was thinking. And he said something that was profound that really stuck with me. He said, "If you want to know the answer to that question, all you need to do is look right here. The human heart's capacity for evil is nearly limitless." He said, "Put yourself in that situation as a 15-year-old boy where you have an AK-47 pointed at your head, and somebody tells you, either you kill these people or I'm going to kill you and your family. What would you do?" Could you say with 100% certainty that you wouldn't? And confronted with that, I had to say, I wasn't sure. I'd like to say that I wouldn't, but I wasn't 100% sure. And the point is that human beings, under the right circumstances, under duress, can do things that are uncharacteristic of them. You know, some of us grew up in a household where secular humanism was celebrated. Maybe we went to a church that was more of the liberal bent, where, you know, we really never were taught about judgment, punishment of God, His justice. I remember talking to my friend, my long-term friend, who grew up going to a mainline denomination, Protestant church that was, you know, had gone liberal. And after he received Christ in our group, he was reflecting back on his experience at his old church, and he said, "You know, I realize now that not once in the revolving door of preachers that would come and be the pastor at our church, I never once heard the gospel taught. I never heard about the judgment of God." And as a result, I think that his tendency is to see the best in humans. He doesn't really grasp this idea of human depravity, which for him, as he's now leading for God, is kind of his Achilles. It's difficult for him. You know, ways to detect imbalances in this direction, I think there are a few. You know, people who have an imbalance towards seeing people in an overly positive life usually say to themselves, you know, if I just stick in there with this person, they'll eventually change. They may not say that out loud, but it suggests two things. Number one, it overinflates human agency. In other words, it suggests that if I just put more effort and work into helping this person, they will change. But there are cases that we can look at, probably in our experience walking with God, where there are people who hit rock bottom, and you're just like, surely this person is going to come to their senses and realize that following God is the only thing that's going to make them fulfilled and happy. And yet they never do. This doesn't square with what Jesus says in Matthew 23 as he's standing over Jerusalem, weeping out of love for them and saying, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how as a mother hen I wanted to gather you together like chicks, but you were unwilling." Jesus loved those people. He loves everyone to a degree that we can't even imagine. And yet there are people, the majority really, who are in rebellion against Christ, in rebellion against God. And so people who say this or act like this really, I think, have an imbalance in seeing people in an overly positive light. Another thing that you sometimes hear from people is, you know, he or she would never fill in the blank. I mean, he would never use the money that he has in his house account for paying bills to pay for his own stuff, to pay his own bills. Oh, really? Never? It's easy to justify when you collect a bunch of people's money and you're down on your bills and you realize, okay, I'm short here. I'm just going to use some of this money. It's already in my account and I'm going to be sure to pay it off. Oh, yeah. Even the most honest person can be faced with that sort of temptation, given the right circumstance. What about people who say, oh, she would never lie to me. I mean, she's never lied to me before. Well, maybe she hasn't found the right situation. Maybe that hasn't come up yet. I remember, again, talking to a leader, and he was recounting this story about how one of our home group leaders was talking to a guy in his group, and the guy indicated that he had fallen into some temptation and got into some sexual sin with a woman who happens to be in another home group. And so he relayed this information to one of the home group leaders who actually happened to be mentoring this woman and said, you know, I think you should ask some questions. I don't know all the details, but there seems to be a reliable story that suggests that, you know, they had fallen into some sin. And so the woman responded, the one who was mentoring this girl said, you know, I highly doubt that. Just dismissed it out of hand. And the other home group leader was like, why don't you think that's true? And she's like, well, I just talked to her about it last week. And I asked her, I said, you know, are you struggling in the area of, you know, physical stuff with your boyfriend? And she said, no. And he's like, well, do you think that maybe she's lying to you? She's like, oh, no. No, she would never lie to me. I mean, you know, we're such good friends. She's never lied to me before. Well, as it turns out, she was lying. But again, you know, a discerning person knows that when you're in sin, there is a tendency to try to cover up the truth. There's a desire to justify self. I mean, think about when you've been busted out for sin in your own life. And, you know, so somebody's asked me, so what happened? And, you know, There's always a tendency to be like, well, you know, this happened. And we know that we're not telling the full truth. We're sort of leaving details out, relevant details, that we justify ourselves. Well, you know, there were these circumstances surrounding it that were really out of my control, and so I sort of happened to do this thing. That's human nature. It's human nature to try to minimize our culpability when we get busted out for something. Another way to detect imbalances in this direction is, you know, sometimes you'll talk to people who, you know, had a hard conversation with someone and say, you know, he's definitely had a turnaround. We had a good talk. You're like, okay, so this person has this persistent chronic problem in their lives that they've been struggling with for years. And you mean to tell me in one conversation that you're certain that they're over it, even though we've had conversations like with him like this in the past? Oh yeah, we had a good talk. People who are discerning know that we look to people's actions as a way to objectively determine whether somebody's repentant rather than what they have to say. Because people are going to say what they know you want to hear. That's, again, human nature, right? To be sorrowful, to be like, yeah, I know, I messed up again, and it's just really bad, and I really want to change. And I think you have to always go back to, what are the actions? What are they doing? That's the most reliable way to figure out where someone's at. And again, I'm not saying that after a conversation that you need to disregard the impression you might have that this person might be having a turnaround. But discerning people are careful to say, you know what, I think he's heading in the right direction, but we'll see. And what that means is we'll see how the next few months go and whether or not he sees some victory in this area. And so they're not real quick to conclude that this person's in the clear, especially if it's something that's been ongoing. I think on the other hand, it's possible to be overly negative. So it's possible to have bad discernment because you see the best in people, but it's also possible to have bad discernment because you see the worst in people. Oh yeah. You know, sometimes being overly negative leads you to assume the worst in people, where we just don't give people the benefit of the doubt. We assume that when we don't hear anything about what they're doing, that they're not doing their job, or that they're incompetent, or that when they're saying something that there's an implied motive that we can see. I remember having an experience like this, sitting in a leadership team meeting where we were discussing this thing that we had talked about several weeks earlier, where one of our leaders was to have a conversation with a woman in our home group about transitioning out of her high school ministry role. And so we were having a follow-up on that, and one of the guys was frustrated because he's like, you know, we're not seeing any movement with her. It doesn't seem like she's deciding one way or another, and it's been 3 weeks. And so he turns to the woman who's supposed to be having the conversation with this woman in high school ministry and was like, you know, when are you going to have this conversation? It's really important. And, you know, the woman was just sitting there taking it, just, you know, quiet. And, you know, he kept going. He was like, you know, when you talk to her, it's really important that you stress that she's been checked out, and it's really doing a disservice to our group that, you know, students look at that and they think, well, why should I take this seriously if one of your leaders don't take this seriously? And, you know, she just sat there, and it was very tense. We were all sitting there watching this happen. And again, he launches in. He's like, you know, so when is this going to happen? I just want to know. I want to nail this down. And finally she spoke up and she said, we talked 2 days ago. And It was amazing to see the blood literally run out of his face. And, you know, after something like that, we just, there was no way to recover. She was like, yeah, you know, a lot of the points that you made, I made with her. And so there was, you know, about 30 second silence as we were sitting there. It was very tense. And I was like, so maybe we should pray here. Why don't you lead us off, brother? Start by repenting of your sin. You know, the wise and discerning person is going to give people the benefit of the doubt. They may have a suspicion, but they're going to ask questions first, rather than launching into an accusation. Think about what Proverbs 11 verse 12 says. The one who denounces his neighbor lacks wisdom, but the one who has discernment keeps silent. And when they decide to open up their mouths, most of the time it's in the form of a question. Remember that. Okay, being overly negative may prevent you from seeing people's potential in Christ. This is really one of the more tragic things that could happen. That you lose sight of what God is doing in this person's life. That because of our frustration with this person, because they've been struggling for years with this same thing, even though we've talked to them about it, that we finally say to ourselves, you know what? She's a hopeless case. Not realizing that God views this person as his son or daughter. Not realizing that God is at work in this person's life, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Not to mention that he promises to work to sanctify this person. It'd be a tragedy if we can't see people the way that God sees them. And it's going to affect the way that we act toward them as well. It may actually lead us to writing them off. And we're not going to say explicitly to them, you know, you over here, I'm done with you. I'm washing my hands of you. You're a pain. Most of the time, we just withdraw emotionally. We avoid. And we just sort of hope they go away. And yet, what if God one day comes to us and says, you know, remember that period of time where you decided to write that person off? Well, I had actually a role for you to play in that person's life. But because you couldn't see it, because you were so negative about them, you never got to play it. So we really need to be careful not to do that. Also, you may be overly negative about other people, but overly positive about your own people. Well, well, well. It's interesting how that works. You can see everybody else's problems crystal clear. But when it comes to your own people, they can do no wrong. Oh yeah. You know, your friends and your family and the people that you're ministering to, I mean, they're practically the second coming of Christ. Everybody else happens to be the devil. And yet it's surprising that people who you know, are overly negative about other people, and you know, when it things turn south for these people in their walk with God, they're like, yeah, I saw that coming a million miles away. But they also get blindsided when their own people that they're working with, that they're trying to love and serve for Christ, end up losing it. They're just like, I'm astonished that this happened. I don't think that somebody who is a discerning Christian worker should ever be like, I'm just shocked that they left. You should be able to see the signs leading up to that. Yeah, you might be surprised by the extent of their sin. But most of the time, a discerning person is going to, when something gets uncovered like that, they're going to say, you know what, that makes sense. That accounts for why they haven't been doing so well over the last few months. That's because they're attuned to their own people and where they're at. We have to lean against our tendency here to view the people around us in a really positive light. And the way that we do that is that we ask people who are reliable, who have good discernment that's proven, what do you think about this woman that I'm investing in? How do you think that she's doing spiritually? Do you think I'm missing something here? They're actively soliciting other people's opinion because they know that it's going to be a lot more objective than their own. Also, being overly negative may lead you to read into other people's motives. This might be what you call over-discerning a situation, where you might be like, well, you know, really the only reason she's saying that is because of this. I mean, she's got an axe to grind, clearly. Oh, really? Well, how do you know that? I mean, it's so obvious, right? I mean, come on. Well, it's not so obvious over here, from my point of view. You know, when there's an absence of data, when there's an absence of facts, we need to suspend judgment. We shouldn't read into people's motives. And a lot of times, the reason why we do that, the reason why we read into people's motives when they say things to us, is because we want to discount what they have to say. It's really a way of discrediting what this person's saying by discrediting them as a person. That way we don't have to face the facts. Well, the real tragedy of doing that is that we might be missing crucial pieces of information because we're just judging this person's motives and dismissing what they have to say. That might lead us to the wrong read. Also, bad discernment might be a result of being mentally disengaged, where you just are checked out. You haven't prayed or thought about people in your group or the people that God has called you to witness to or serve. And so you just haven't really thought about it. So you go into your time with those people or to your meeting and you're just limping in, reacting. Whereas people who have good discernment, a lot of times they're agonizing, they're thinking, they're reflecting on those people throughout the week. Okay, another aspect of this is judging situations correctly. So it's not just about understanding people, it's also understanding how people work in certain environments. I think one thing you see is people jumping to conclusions without seeking to hear the other side of the story. Yeah, that's a classic error of bad discernment right there. I remember this one time, a number of years back, there was this woman in one of the groups that I was overseeing who was in conflict with a lot of people in her life. She was bitter. And so as a result, the leadership team decided, you know what, there's this responsibility of leading her ministry house that's coming up, but we decide that maybe we should hold off on that because we want to hold out on this issue getting somewhat resolved. And of course, they explained it to her, and she was really upset. She went to her parents, who are also in Xenos, complained to them. And then, of course, her parents went to other parents and started complaining and saying that their daughter had been mistreated. Well, one day at one of our leadership gatherings, where, you know, there's a number of teachings that are given, and it's a place for leaders to get together and just talk about issues and leadership, this woman came up to the woman's mentor and just, you know, stood by her and looked over and said, "So I heard about that conflict you're in." And the woman's mentor was like, "Do I know you?" She's like, "You know, really, you're the older sister here, so you should be the more mature one." And you know what? That teaching that was just given about conflict, I think you need to re-listen to that and just let that sink in. Without even asking any questions, by, you know, with her third or fourth hand account of what happened, she just launches in on this woman. And, you know, she has bad discernment. People who have good discernment always know that there are two sides to a story, especially when it comes to conflict. And we need to seek that out. We need to hear the other side of the story, because a lot of times there are miscommunications, that it's a complex issue. And so we need to try to obtain the facts before we come to any sort of conclusion. Another thing that An error that I think people run into is what you might call the case law approach. Oh yeah, the case law approach is where you encounter a scenario and you go to your mental database, which has an index of subjects. Drunkenness. You go to drunkenness, that topic, and you look at the catalog of examples that you can think of in your mind. And then based on that, you just come up with sort of a wooden approach to whatever scenario you're in. That's what you might call the case law approach. Now, the reason that that's flawed is because a lot of times discerning people are able to see nuances in the current situation that are a little bit different than others that they've experienced in the past. In fact, having good discernment oftentimes means that you can see those differences crystal clear. I'll give you another example. A number of years ago, I was living with a couple guys who struggled with drinking. One guy was getting drunk over a period of months, and eventually the leadership team decided, you know what, I think that it's best for you to maybe take a break from the ministry house and move out. And, you know, we all felt like that was probably the right thing for this guy. And then a few months later, another guy in our ministry house started getting drunk over a period of weeks, and surprisingly, the leadership team didn't do anything about it. And I was confused. I'm like, well, what's going on here? I mean, here's this guy who's doing the exact same thing as this other guy. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. And so I asked one of the leaders, and I said, what do you think about this? And he said, well, you have to understand that it's a little bit more complex than that. That this other guy, he's been around for years. He doesn't seem that eager to serve. We've talked to him numerous times about this drunkenness thing, and he just still won't listen. And so we felt like asking him to leave the ministry house would actually raise the tension with him and cause him to come to his senses. Whereas this other guy, he's only been walking with God for less than a year. He had a drinking problem before he came around, and he confessed right away. And so we felt like these were just different cases here. And I thought to myself, that makes a lot more sense. Not to mention, I was looking at it from the wrong perspective, where I was thinking to myself, what's the right or wrong thing to do here versus what's the most loving thing we can do for this person? And so the case law approach, I think, is ineffective when applied in a wooden way. Now let me qualify this by saying that as you grow in your walk with God and you compile more experiences and examples that you see, that it actually does increase your discernment. But it shouldn't be the only factor in deciding what you're going to do in a specific situation. Balancing that with putting too much stock into your intuition. Oh yeah! This is a shot at those of you who might be what you might call hyper-intuitive. Hyper-intuitive people. Oh yeah, we get feelings. They're preternatural. Let's get a feeling about this situation and this person, man. I don't know. And we stick to that. It's an impression that's so strong that a lot of times the facts that emerge, they won't change our impression, no matter how objective. You know, sometimes having strong intuitions can be a great thing because they can lead to penetrating insight, but most of the time it leads to bad discernment. Okay? Somebody who is discerning actually does have strong intuitions most of the time. People who are gifted in discernment are intuitive people usually. But they've learned over the years to question their reads and to be open to the fact that there may be things that emerge, facts of the case, that will influence the way that we see the current scenario. And so I like how Professor of philosophy at Boston College, Peter Kreef, puts it. He says, always begin with the data, with what we know for sure, judging the unknown by the known, the uncertainty by the certain. I think that's generally pretty true. It's okay to have an intuition, but make sure that it fits with the facts. And when it doesn't fit with the facts, you should be humble enough to disregard or to get rid of your intuition that you felt so strongly about. Also, black and white thinking. Black and white thinkers approach any scenario, and there are really only two ways to look at it, the right way and the wrong way. There is no such thing as gray area. And so our job is to locate that, to figure it out. Discerning people understand that we face very complex and gray area issues in ministry, that maybe in any given situation, there may be three or four ways to approach the situation, and really it's a matter of picking the best one. And so this is hard to break, and I think it takes a little bit of experience and failure to break us of black and white thinking. Okay, I want to sort of end here by giving some practical tips on how to hone your discernment in this area of understanding people and situations. I think, first of all, admit that you have bad discernment if you've got it. People with bad discernment are notorious for thinking that they've got great discernment. And it's likely that there are some people who have really bad discernment who think they've got good discernment who decided not to come to this. That's why I call this honing your discernment. The fact that you're eager to come here and learn maybe more about discernment in our dialogue here, in our attempt to become more discerning people, indicates that you have some level of discernment. But admit it. It's like a bad addiction. The first step to recovery is admitting that you've got a problem. If you're addicted to bad discernment, please admit it. Secondly, make sure sin isn't clouding your perception. You know, that secret habit, that bitterness that you have in your life can really cloud your judgment. That value that you prioritize over God, that can cloud your perception. Think about what Jesus says when it comes to material wealth. He says, if your eyes are bad, speaking of the evil eye, the greedy eye, he says, your whole body will be full of darkness. And if then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Oh yeah, if you're in sin, I mean, it's going to just cloud your perception. Also, ask God for discernment and wait on His answer. I mentioned in my prayer, James 1, that if you ask God, that He's generous and that He'll grant you wisdom without reproach and generously. But a lot of times we have to wait, and in listening prayer, where we're mentally engaged, thinking about whatever it is that we're asking God about, to allow God to speak to our thoughts through the Holy Spirit. Also, regularly seek counsel. Think about what Proverbs 11, verse 14 says, when there is no guidance, a nation falls, but there is success in the abundance of counselors. People who I know who are great at discernment get counsel. Yeah, that's important. Also, surround yourself with people who have reliable discernment. One of my guys who I've mentored, he struggles in this area of discernment. And I remember sending him off as a leader, and you know, he would come up with these wacky reads, or he would just miss things. And eventually I was like, you know, I can't keep meeting with you for the rest of your life helping you discern situations. You need to be proactive and find people that you're around who have good discernment. Seek them out and bounce your ideas off of them. Also, ask good questions. Be a good listener. Hope that came through in my talk, that instead of launching into an accusation or just presupposing something, ask questions. It's safe to do that. And be a good listener. Be willing to take in the input. Think about what Proverbs 17, verse 10 says, a rebuke makes greater impression on a discerning person than 100 blows on a fool. Oh yeah, a discerning person knows that there's a tendency to be wrong. That we sometimes don't see things straight, and that we need people's input. All right, those are my thoughts on honing your discernment. Again, here's my email address, hilarioc@zenos.org, if you want the PowerPoint. I guess we've got maybe, you know, a couple minutes for some questions. If you have a question, raise your hand and we'll get a mic over to you. Yeah, right over here.
What advice do you have for people who just like reserving judgment or discernment, like don't want to make a call in either direction?
Can you hold on a second? Can you boost that up? I'm having trouble hearing her. Okay, sorry.
What advice do you have for people who just want to withhold judgment or discernment, like don't really want to go in either direction?
I didn't catch the last part of that. Full discernment or?
No, just don't want to make a decision.
Okay. A decision about what specifically?
Either like about the truth of a statement or about the way to go forward in a personal relationship or whatever.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to people who don't want to make a decision, specifically, I mean, I guess one way to look at that is people who don't want to make a decision either to, respond to something that we've confronted them on. I think that, again, it requires a little bit of discernment. It depends on your history with that person, how many conversations you've had with them, looking for an opportune time. I think there are some times where, you know, we get stuck spiritually and where we're not responding to God. And thankfully, the discerning people in my life, the wise people in my life, didn't decide to keep hammering me with the truth, but instead gave me some breathing room to sort of sort things out and looking for a more opportune time to bring it up. So I think that it's a little bit difficult to figure out how to deal with people who don't want to make a decision. But I think it's important for us to seek counsel and see what other people think. If you mean not make a decision about what people say or what they mean about things, yeah, I think that that's good. I think that it's okay to suspend judgment. If somebody says something that's ambiguous, I may have a suspicion about what they're saying, but if I don't really have anything that objectively I can point to and say, it's clear she meant this or he meant this, then I'm just going to say, he said this, and I'm not sure what that means, but I think that, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt here. So, okay, right over here. Keep your hand raised here. Oh, okay, we'll take Feeney. It's fine.
Yeah, I was just, I don't know, some of the people that I've seen grow into stable, discerning people aren't really gifted in discernment.
Yeah.
But what they were gifted at was just really like getting in the Word and understanding it. And I was just kind of thinking about what she was talking about, as well as just a lot of your points where, you know, if you have a proper grasp of the Word and you're really in your Word, then you can almost always just help people sit and think through, even if you're not necessarily gifted in discernment. It's like, okay, well, where does this line up with what God says about, like if it's a career or a school, about, you know, materialism or what we live for, putting God first. And just by knowing your Word at a deep level, even when you're not gifted here, you can become a highly, highly advantageous source of counsel for people.
Yeah, and I hope that came through in my talk here, that, and really I don't think that the whole premise of this talk is that you can get discernment if you don't have it. Because I think some people say to themselves, I'm just really bad at discernment and it's just not going to change, because there are some people who are gifted and some who are not. But again, I think that the Bible implies that you can obtain God's wisdom, that you can obtain this kind of discernment, and that it's something that you get through practice and training your perceptions. And so I think that it's something we need to work at. And people who are gifted at discernment are hungry to keep sharpening their discernment. You know, guys I know who I consider to be discerning people, they're still bouncing ideas off of people. And I think that's a good quality. I think that's something that we need to keep striving toward. Okay, over here.
So I have a friend who he thinks he can read people really well.
And yeah.
Like, you know, I forget what it's called exactly, but you get their body language or whatever. And it seems like he really like reads into people's motives a lot based on his ability to read body language. And like it seems to assume certain attitudes or and stuff. What would you say to someone who does stuff like that? Or like how can they, if they actually do read body language, how could they use that in a way that's more loving? Or
well, I do think that body language can reveal whether somebody's lying or maybe their feeling state. I think that those are helpful things, but a lot of times I just stick to what they say. And I think that that's really the most important thing is learning how to be a careful listener. And I think with your friend, I think maybe one thing you can say to him is, you know, when you read into my motives, it creates a little bit of distance relationally. Because when you're assuming certain things about me or what I'm saying, you know, it makes me feel like you don't trust me, that I'm hiding something, or that there's something underneath the surface that I'm trying to convey that is, you know, I guess kind of a negative or evil or something like that. And I would reflect that back to him and say, you know, I think that you're well-intended, but sometimes it comes off this way. And I'd also point out, too, that, you know, reading into people's motives can cause you to be blindsided by situations because you might be dismissing real facts and relying too much on your impression of a conversation. Good question. Yeah, right up here. It'll be the last one since we're out of time here.
Hopefully this isn't too vague, but maybe you could speak on this. There's kind of like a line that I feel like I don't have a good time discerning between, like, is this a discerning thought or is this a cynical thought?
Yeah.
I feel like I end up in either camp, mostly the cynical camp sometimes, and I don't realize I'm there. I think I'm discerning. Maybe you could speak on that.
You need to know what your tendency is. You know that you tend to be overly positive about people, then you should be really negative about people. No, I'm just kidding. It doesn't work that way. I just think you should be aware of your tendency. And if you're confused about it, you should ask somebody and say, you know, this is my impression of this situation. And do you think that I'm being overly positive or do you think I'm being overly negative here? And people who know you and know the situation will probably give you a pretty good idea of that. So lean against your tendency and ask questions. Get input.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.